only a game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, since 1985 offering discerning patients and dentists options for same-day replacement of missing and compromised teeth. Information online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Historically, members of the Minnesota Timberwolves should be preparing to meet each other on the first tee. By virtue of last night's 102-91 victory over the Denver Nuggets, however, this year's Timberwolves are looking forward to playing in round two of the NBA playoffs. Over the past 7 years, the Timberwolves had lost in round one an NBA record 7 times. In its 15-year history, Minnesota had never advanced beyond round one. In Miami last night, the Heat beat the New Orleans Hornets 87-83 to assume a 3-2 lead in their first-round series. The Heat had to overcome a 33-point performance by Baron Davis of New Orleans. In NHL playoff action last night, the Toronto Maple Leafs smothered the Philadelphia Flyers 3-1. Matt Sundin scored twice in that game, which evened the series at 2 games apiece. It is the day upon which people who pay attention to horse racing for one day each year are paying attention. This afternoon, Churchill Downs in Louisville, Kentucky, will host the 130th running of the Kentucky Derby. Today's Derby is characterized by a large field, considerable disagreement over which horse is likely to finish at the front of it, an old jockey in the midst of a remarkable comeback, and a very young trainer. Joining me now to discuss the specifics of these plot lines, as well as to provide us with an absolute lock winner of the race, is Jenny Rees of the Louisville Courier-Journal. Jenny, welcome back to Only a Game.
Great to be here. Bill, you have such confidence in me.
Utter confidence. I cannot remember you ever failing to pick the winner, and so we'll proceed.
Absolutely.
Jockey Shane Sellers is easy to root for this time around. He's 37 years old. He's come back from a terrible knee injury. And in 20 tries, he's never won a Triple Crown race. He's come up empty in 12 derbies. Do you like his chances this afternoon on the cliff's edge?
Well, this is a kiss of death, but that's my pick.
Ah.
So sorry about your luck, Shane. But no, I think that he absolutely has the right horse this year. It is wide open, but this horse has fewer knocks on him than I'd say any other horse. And Shane was a winner Thursday in federal court. He was part of the suit that got the right for jockeys to wear commercial endorsements on their pants.
Absolutely. And do we know what endorsements any of the particular jockeys will be wearing on their pants?
No, we don't. Thursday, when the ruling came down, they were wearing some Jockeys Guild patches that they had also gone to court for, to bring awareness to the Disabled Jockeys Fund and the plight of jockeys that aren't as fortunate as Shane and that do suffer debilitating injuries. But I don't know if they'll have time to get anything ready to, you know, have a full-fledged billboard on their pants by the race or not.
Bettors who base their wagers on the trainer are not likely to back a horse called Imperialism, a gray colt trained by Kristen Mulhall. They just don't have enough to go on. Mulhall is a rarity in the backstretch on Derby Day for two reasons. She's female and she's 21 years old. What else has she got going for her?
Well, her horse is really small. You probably go back to Dancer's Image to see a horse that small win, but it is amazing with Kristen. I mean, 21 years old, she's barely old enough to drink, and she hasn't been able to even have a license on the racetrack that many years, but she's got great instincts with horses, and she's done a terrific job with this horse, Imperialism.
Jenny, some horse players swear by a measure of racing efficiency called the speed figure. This is a statistic developed by track writer Andy Beyer. Read the Footnotes is the horse who boasts the best speed figure among the Derby horses. Tell me briefly what the speed figure is and whether it matters.
Well, it's a way that's supposed to be scientific, that's to take the subjectiveness out of determining how fast the horse ran. So it's supposed to take into account how fast the track was playing and track condition and things like that, how deep it was. The problem is humans do it, therefore it is subjective. But by all accounts, when Read the Footnotes won the Fountain of Youth in February and got a Beyer of 113, it was an outstanding performance. It was fast. He had a stretch long duel with a very good horse named Second of June, who actually came out of the race with a leg fracture, some people might say, from perhaps trying so hard. That's how hard the horses were running. But then, to show how fickle people are in racing, when Read the Footnotes came back in the Florida Derby, was fourth and got a low Beyer speed figure. Now he is out of sight, out of mind, and his trainer, Rick Violet, says it's not even what you've done for me lately in racing. It's what have you done for me today?
Oh,
so he is much the forgotten horse. But if you believe in Byers, he has run the fastest race. And if he runs back to that race, then he's really going to be a threat.
Smarty Jones, the horse that won the Arkansas Derby, has been referred to as Rocky-esque. What accounts for this designation?
Well, the fact that he came from Philly Park. Wasn't Rocky Philadelphia?
Absolutely.
And they've got a great ball cap that the Pennsylvania breeders put out that says, Smarty Jones, the real Philadelphia Flyer. And he can fly. He is a very fast horse. And to me, I've heard some people say, what kind of Derby name is that? I think it's a fabulous name for a Derby winner. Smarty Jones, and as a colleague said, you even got the book title right there, because he stands to win $5 million bonus if he wins this race. So Smarty starts with an S, ends with an S. Put $2 signs there instead of the S's in the title of the book.
All right, enough with the cute names and the idle speculation. You like Shane Sellers aboard the Cliff's Edge this afternoon, so that's what we go with, right?
That's what we go with.
Jenny Reese of the Louisville Courier-Journal has been joining me each Derby day for some years now, and as I say, as far as I recall, she has never failed to pick the winner of the race.
I think your memory's pretty short, thank goodness. I do have a very good streak going, we'll say.
Jenny, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Over the last 57 years, Alex Harthill has earned a reputation as one of horse racing's premier veterinarians. The frail-looking 78-year-old has cared for countless contenders, as well as Kentucky Derby winners Ponder, Ferdinand, and Sunday Silence. But he's also been involved in his share of controversy. From Louisville, Kentucky, Kathleen Adams reports.
It's a rainy April morning, and Dr. Alex Harthill navigates his way through the rows of horse barns on the backside of Churchill Downs. Harthill pulls in front of the barn of longtime client William Jinx Fires. The trainer has a young horse suffering from breathing problems, something that could impede its performance on the racetrack. A groom uses a lead halter to hold the two-year-old gelding still, but Harthill inserts a flexible fiber optic scope through the horse's right nostril so he can examine the animal's respiratory system.
Well, I saw a lot of inflammation. We got to give him some drugs that'll help shrink that and give him antibiotics.
His diagnosis made, Harthill, whose rounds usually begin around 4 a.m., returns to his car for the trip back to his office. There, the rooms and hallways are crammed with horse racing memorabilia and artifacts that attest to the legend of Dr. Harthill. There's a handwritten note from thoroughbred trainer Horatio Lauro thanking Harthill for treating Northern Dancer, winner of the 1964 Kentucky Derby. Harthill admits giving the horse a then illegal anti-bleeding medication called Lasix prior to the big race.
That's the leading sire of all time. That was my first Lasix horse. There's no horse in the world that's made as much of an impression on breeding as he has.
Unapologetic, Harthill says he also administered the anti-inflammatory butazolidine to Bold Ruler, the betting favorite in the 1957 Kentucky Derby. At the time, it too was an illegal medication.
I gave it to him because he had a ledge on his knee that caused him discomfort. And a guy named Marcaro, who was a real rider, was on him. And he said, he called me up and he said, Doc, I'm riding a horse. It could be anybody in the world. He said, if you can cure his knee or whatever's hurting him, he says, I'll beat them all.
Despite Harthill's efforts, Eddie Arcaro and Bold Ruler finished fourth. Billy Reed, a former sports reporter for the Louisville Courier-Journal, says no one has handled more Derby horses than Dr. Harthill.
He's been treating Kentucky Derby horses beginning with Citation in 1948, and he was right out of vet school at that point. If you could imagine anybody coming out of vet school and immediately you're treating a horse that went on to win the Triple Crown and become one of racing's all-time greats. So he obviously was well-connected. Yet, if you go look in the files of the Thoroughbred Racing Protective Bureau, I mean, his file is bulging with stuff involving allegations of misconduct in various states. He's had his license taken away, and there has been that other dark side to his whole personality.
Perhaps the biggest controversy associated with Harthill was his involvement with the winner of the 1968 Kentucky Derby, Dancer's Image. The only horse ever to be disqualified after winning a Derby because of a positive drug test, Harthill was his attending veterinarian, and Billy Reed was assigned to the story.
I went out to the barn where Dancer's Image had been stabled, which in fact was known then as Doc Harthill's barn. It was barn 24. He had an office in there. took some pictures. I had a camera with me, and he was not there. And then as I was walking off, I heard somebody yell, hey, hey. And I looked around, and it's Harthill, and he's coming right at me. And, you know, when he got up there, I stuck up my hand. I said, you must be Dr. Harthill. I'm Billy Reed from the Courier-Journal. And he grabbed my hand, and then with his other hand, he hit me with a roundhouse punch and knocked me right flat on my back.
To this day, Harthill denies any wrongdoing, but the owner of Dancer's Image, Boston businessman Peter Fuller, always believed that the vet interfered with the outcome of the 1968 Derby. Peggy Whittingham, the widow of two-time Kentucky Derby-winning trainer Charlie Whittingham, is among the supporters of Dr. Harthill. She says her husband sought out Harthill whenever he had a horse in a big race.
He really loved his horses, and he was very good with horses, and he felt that Dr. Harthill was one of the best veterinarians that he'd ever known. And he had a few, you know, in California, but Doc Harthill was his favorite.
For his part, Harthill seems almost amused by the attention he attracts. He believes some people are suspicious of him because they don't understand horses.
Horses change with the slightest breeze. The apparent soundest horse in the world can go sour overnight, or should I say, while you're looking at them, either training or running in a field. Good form vanishes without warning.
Dr. Alex Harthill would not disclose which Derby contenders he's currently treating. For Only a Game, I'm Kathleen Adams in Louisville, Kentucky.
It's 18 minutes past the hour.
She's well acquainted with the touch of a velvet hand, like a lizard on a window pane.
Tony Mullen was unfortunate in that he was only 63 when he died earlier this spring after a year-long illness. The remains of his remains, I'll explain that in a minute, were buried in Dundalk, near the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland. But Tony Mullen was lucky in that he had friends willing to carry out his final request. That explains why Willie Hughes, Tony Mullen's shooting partner of 20 years, packed some of Mullen's ashes into 50 cartridges and has been firing those cartridges at clay pigeons all over the world. "Every ground I go to, I fire one off," Willie Hughes said recently. Tony would have done the same for me. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, hooks, rows, and back post stitches across America. But first,
there are a lot of people, owners, trainers, racetracks, making an ungodly amount of money. And the guys that are suffering are us.
That's Shane Sellers in the documentary Jockey, which premiered on HBO's America Undercover this week. In the film, Sellers, future Hall of Famer Randy Romero, and apprentice jockey Chris Rozier candidly expose the risks and damage riders must endure while guiding 1,200-pound horses around a track, all the while maintaining weight just over 110 pounds. Kate Davis directed the film, and she joins me from NPR's New York Bureau. Kate, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you.
Those who are familiar with horse racing probably know some of what jockeys endure to maintain weight, but I think the extent of the abuse these riders inflict on their bodies will surprise a lot of people. When you set out to make this movie, did you know what you would eventually find?
No, I really was starting out with a hunch that there was a dark side to being a rider. I read an article. I knew the weight regime seemed a little bit extreme. But little did I know that these guys flip, as they call it, and heave, throw up their food often 10 times a day, that they sit in hot boxes, which are saunas, for several hours every morning, losing 6, 7, 8 pounds, that they take diuretics, everything at the same time, which wreaks havoc on their organs.
At one point in the documentary, while rehabbing from a knee injury and looking fit and healthy at 23 pounds over his riding weight, Sellers goes on a tour of the locker room.
The oldest way of pulling weight was the hot box, the sweat box, where most of the riders pull their weight and some riders get in it every day. Well, this is what I call jail. You know, it was, wasn't happy. I don't have a lot of happy memories about this place.
It's hard to imagine seeing that, why Sellers would be working so hard to make a comeback. Did you find his reasons compelling?
I certainly did. I mean, for most civilians, it seems insane. It's how can these guys put their bodies through what they do? But I wanted to underscore also in the movie that they have found something they love. They have been riding mostly since they were 7, 8, 9 years old, and they don't know anything else, as Shane would say. And the thrill of winning is something that gets in their blood, and it's like an addiction. So it's not so simple for them to walk away and, I don't know, you know, become a waiter at a restaurant. They're not interested in anything but living life at the track.
It's kind of ironic, isn't it, that at one point in the film he's seeing some of the people at the track that he hasn't seen in a while because he's been away with an injury, and they all tell him how good he looks. Well, he looks good because he weighs 135 instead of 116.
Exactly, and remember his wife also is terrified of seeing him lose 23 pounds because he gets that concentration camp look, as they call it. Mm. And that's just a universal reality. You walk in any jock's room, that's what you see. Shane Sellers has done a lot of research and found that medical doctors say it's very unhealthy to stay at anything below 5% body fat, and riders are at something like 2 to 3% body fat, which means your body is cannibalizing itself. But the weights are beginning to change, and Shane has been fighting a very tough battle. And, you know, we caught it in the film, in a historic moment, when the racing industry started to pay attention. I think this film will pressure them more to raise the weights just a couple of pounds. That makes a huge difference to these guys.
Shane Sellers shows the special commode at the track that the jockeys use to heave, his term. Chris Rozier discusses how difficult it is to stop the practice over a hamburger, fries, and a bowl of chili, ironically enough. All the while, Randy Romero is waiting for a kidney and liver transplant that he needs after years of bulimia. Did Romero's illness prompt your subjects to speak so candidly about this problem?
We actually didn't know when we began filming that Randy's health was suddenly going to fail, that his kidney would fail, his liver. That happened well into the filming. Shane had made the decision that it was better to speak out for future riders, even if he never rode again. And then when Randy's health declined, Shane took it as a further reason to fight the system. I mean, here is his best friend who's suddenly facing his death after 20 years of bulimia.
The racing community, or at least one little corner of the racing community, comes together and raises $200,000 for Romero's transplant fund, which is terrific. That's a great story. But why is it necessary? Why don't riders have insurance?
Most riders are not from the polo set, let's just say. They are raised rather in impoverished settings. And, you know, the three in my film came from Louisiana, from the outbacks of Louisiana, and most of them quit school in 8th grade, 9th grade, and they don't know about getting insurance. They just start riding. So when they start to go down and have accidents, it's extremely easy for them to be paying off health bills for the rest of their lives. Mm. That's why Randy, an absolute top star former rider, though he made millions, he still had spent it all after 23 race-related accidents. Mm.
Well, as a result of Randy Romero's illness and his condition, Sellers, as you point out, goes on this campaign to raise the minimum weight for jockeys.
I just wish somebody would give me a good answer, a good explanation why they don't want to raise the weight. And if they could, then I'd say, you know what? I love the game, okay? That's what I need to go through, and that's the only way I have to go through it, then I'm going to go through it. Thank you for trying.
In the film, you don't talk to any track or racing officials about the minimum weights. Did you get into asking them about why this hadn't happened before?
Well, I think that's a really good question. We would have included more voices from officials if they had anything to do with the riders. There was very little communication between them. And I thought, above all, I wanted the film to depict the rider's point of view, what it's like to be a rider day after day. And I didn't want it to turn into what you might call a more investigative report kind of film with everybody's different opinion. You get a little bit of it through the Connie Chung scene, where you hear that trainers, you know, are caring about the horses. They have some explanations in terms of thinking that more weight will hurt the horses, which is, of course, debatable. But honestly, I didn't see our riders or any other riders really have a whole lot of contact with the trainers over this matter. Shane was speaking out. He was putting his words in the newspaper and wasn't getting a whole lot of response.
As is likely apparent by now, some portions of the film are difficult to watch, but anybody's first impression is going to be how beautiful and photogenic the horses are when they're running. Was that part of the initial attraction of making the documentary?
Well, I think that there's an incredible beauty to horse racing. I mean, the animals are phenomenally structured, and of course the colors of the silks are so memorable and bright. And the Derby Day itself, I've been to several derbies, it's a dreamy experience. Mm. It's timeless. It's just wonderful being out there. And one of the initial attractions, I have to say, is that I wanted to set the kind of glory and the beauty and color of the track against the dark reality of these riders' lives.
Chris Rozier has recently been diagnosed with diabetes. Randy Romero is still waiting to be placed on a transplant list for a kidney and a liver. And Shane Sellers, at 117 pounds, will be riding the cliff's edge in today's Kentucky Derby. Obviously, Sellers thinks his comeback was worth it. Do you?
Boy, you know, to me, it's a bittersweet ending. It is a dark victory. Part of me roots for Sellers to go do his country music and become an ex-star with his singing. On the other hand, here's a guy who's found what he loves, and that's a hard thing to deny.
Kate Davis directed Jockey for HBO. Kate, thank you very much for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you. Some things need a change.
It seems that one of our stories last week caused a bit of confusion. Just to clarify, the sport reporter Karen Given witnessed was an extreme version of croquet, the outdoor game where players use long-handled mallets to drive balls through a series of wickets, not extreme crochet. But in the interest of journalistic excellence, we sent her out to find that story as well.
You've probably seen their handiwork before. If you've ever come across a gaily crocheted bow around an old oak tree in the middle of the woods, it was extreme crocheters who put it there. But it was with more than the usual fanfare last fall that the ladies of the Connecticut Extreme Crochet Society set out on their latest quest.
Ladies, 100 years ago today, our grandmothers and great-grandmothers began their trek across the United States to crochet a gold scarf across this continent. Those brave souls only made it to this spot in Des Moines, Iowa. I say, let's finish the job!
My name is Ida Collinsworth, and I'm 81 years old. In 1904, my grandmother left her young children behind, destitute, to crochet a gold scarf. That's the color of suffrage, you understand. They hoped that when they showed this country their courage and pluck, not to mention excellent skills with a double-ended crochet hook, the constitutional amendment to give women the vote would finally be ratified. They failed, of course, but in their quest for suffrage, they pioneered new paths in the sport of extreme croquet.
You mean crochet?
Whatever.
Ida, you do know that women have the vote.
Oh, don't be silly. If women had the vote, don't you think more than 51% of the people would have voted in the last presidential election?
And so, with hundreds of balls of yarn on hand and more stashed at key rest stops along the way, the women of the Extreme Crochet Society begin their work.
7.5 months later, the ladies have made it to Interstate 80 near Lake Tahoe. In the 1840s, the Donner Party became stranded just a few miles east of here when they were unable to make it over the mountains before winter hit. Today, an unexpected spring blizzard and a dangerously short supply of yarn has left these women in similar straits. But nothing will distract Gertrude Miller from her task. She's today's master crocheter.
It's the people, mostly. You can't find people like this just anywhere, you know. Besides, my great-aunt Gertie helped to crochet the original scarf back in the 1900s, and if it's good enough for my great-aunt Gertie, it's good enough for me.
Extreme crochet is not all tea and crumpets.
I could have sworn there was a Starbucks around here somewhere.
These women are competitive, a trait that becomes apparent as Ida stops by to survey Gertrude's intricate and tightly woven work.
Excuse me, Gertrude, but is that a number 6 hook you're using?
Why, yes. This is the same hook that Great Aunt Gertie used 100 years ago.
Those stitches are too small, too tight. There's no way we're going to make it to our next resupply in Sacramento now.
If the number 6 hook was good enough for Great Aunt Gertie, it's good enough for me.
But you've ruined us.
I said if the number 6 hook was good enough for Great Aunt Gertie, it's good enough for me.
Eventually, cooler heads manage to come up with a plan. Someone will volunteer to hitchhike back to Reno to retrieve more yarn. Actually, according to Extreme Crochet custom, the youngest woman on site is required to volunteer.
I'm sorry, hun, but it's the rules. You go.
But hitchhiking is dangerous. Can't I take the bus?
If hitchhiking was good enough for my great aunt Gertie, it's good enough for you.
But I didn't even want to be here. They promised me if I did a good job on my last report, I could cover a real sport this time.
I said go.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon. At mile 184, that's 184 on Interstate 80 near Lake Tahoe. If you happen to be in the area, could you please pick me up? Hurry, please.
Women's professional tennis has enjoyed increased popularity over the last few years, turning out stars as glamorous and charismatic as they are athletic. But the sport also has its share of players who serve and volley in relative obscurity. In Tokyo, reporter Robert Rand met one of those.
In professional women's tennis, you know some of the big American names, the Williams sisters, Venus and Serena. Between them, combined career earnings exceeding $25 million. And Lindsay Davenport, a tour veteran whose racket has raked in more than $16
million. ただいまウォーミングアップをしておりますでしょうご紹介いたします。Let's introduce players. 審判台の右側、right of the chair, Lindsay Davenport 選手、アメリカ。
Davenport was among a handful of U.S. women who recently participated in the Pan Pacific Open in Tokyo.Davenport won the competition, pocketing $189,000. Another compatriot was there. You've probably never heard of her.
My name is Abigail Spears. I'm 22 years old. And when the year began, I was ranked 204 on the Women's Professional Tennis Tour.
In professional women's tennis, 204 doesn't get you very far. Spears says last year,
I earned $54,000. And I spent about $52,000.
$52,000 out of her own pocket. Most of it went for airfare and hotels. For anonymous pluggers like Abigail Spears, there's not a lot of profit. Here, a sad and all too familiar scene for Abigail Spears. She's the only player on the Tokyo tournament bus heading back to her hotel after an early tournament exit. Defeat, she says, is a fellow traveler, and life on the tour is far from glamorous.
A lot of the players starting out, when I started, there was a lot of girls from other countries, from Yugoslavia and part of Europe, and they would sleep in cars, they would drive to tournaments and sleep in cars, and they would maybe go without dinner.
Spears, a California native who likes to surf and mountain bike when she's off the tennis courts, says she's never slept in cars, but she has crashed on hotel room floors. A couple of companies give her free tennis equipment, but there's no endorsement money coming in. For Spears and her lower-ranked colleagues, the only source of income is tournament prize money. And for the most part, they aren't going very far in tournaments.
It's pretty tough. I mean, you have to start kind of like in the minor leagues, and my dream is to break into the top 50. I do believe, now I'm starting to believe, that I can.
As for those highly ranked players, the Williams sisters, the Davenports, and the like,
they're around in the locker rooms, and you pass by them on your way to the courts, and maybe you share a court with them, but we don't really talk. I don't think they respect me, because they don't know me, so not around. I'm not knocking off players here and there, so not yet, anyways.
So, for the time being, Abigail Spears labors in anonymity, by her own estimation, pretty much just getting by. In Tokyo, by the way, she played 4 matches, lost 3, and earned $3,864.
Robert Rand is an independent radio producer based in Tashkent, Uzbekistan. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston, where Only a Game is produced. Additional support comes from Thermo Electron, the scientific instruments company with a mission to advance drug discovery, improve manufacturing, and protect people and the environment, on the web at thermo.com. And from Hotel Commonwealth Boston, located in the Fenway Park neighborhood, near historic mansions, universities, medical institutions, and cultural sites. Information at hotelcommonwealth.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, anarchy in the aerobics class is coming sometime, maybe. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
That was a Sex Pistols album, wasn't it?
Yes, you've got the special clue. Nicely done.
Thank you very much. And welcome back, to our friends at Minnesota Public Radio from Marshall
and
to War Road.
And they're back just in time because the Timberwolves have at long last won an NBA playoff series, eliminating the Denver Nuggets last night. Lucky Minnesotans now have more playoff basketball and more public radio sports. Life is good.
How could it be any better for our friends in Minnesota?
Meanwhile, the Dallas Mavericks have disappointed their fans even earlier in the playoffs than usual. They were eliminated by Sacramento on Thursday night. Will there be a revolution in Cuban land?
Well, I think that, number one, I think you've got to wonder if Don Nelson and Mark Cuban can maintain their relationship any longer. They've had a really good team for a really long time and don't really have anything to show for it. They brought in both of the Antoines, both with different spellings, Antoine Walker and Antoine Jameson. Antoine Jameson was the sixth man of the year. Antoine Walker was not. I suspect he'll be playing somewhere else.
What Taoist lessons do you think Yao Ming has taken from the Rockets dismantling at the hands of the Lakers?
I'm not exactly sure. The Lakers are continuing to be the most fascinating team in any sport anywhere. They all hate each other. One guy, he has to keep flying back from court appearances in Denver. The big Aristotle is not happy with anything. Gary Payton, who they brought in to be their clutch point guard, doesn't play at the end of games very much anymore. And still they stagger on, and now they have to play the Spurs, who put an end to their title reign in the second round, and the Spurs are playing better than anybody right now.
Charlie, I'm sure you will wish to celebrate the re-employment of a Marquette guy bound for Boston.
Hey, Doc Rivers, who I watched first play at the Boston Shootout High School All-Star Tournament. Low 1980, many years ago, has come in to try to get this listing, plague-ridden, miserable Hulk off the bottom of the ocean and get it moving in the right direction. If you can do it by pure optimism, he'll do it.
My favorite NBA story of the week actually has Defensive Player of the Year Ron Artest offering to give his award to Bruce Bowen of the Spurs if Bowen can beat him in a game of one-on-one. How did that possibility come about?
Well, there's been some lipping off between Artest and Greg Popovich, the coach of the San Antonio Spurs, who believes his man Bruce Bowen should have won the award. Artest reacted horribly. Artest would win, by the way, if anyone's interested. He would win the game pretty handily. But I certainly wouldn't mind seeing it at halftime.
I think it'd be great. The Tampa Bay Lightning shocked the Montreal hockey fans with a sweep of the Canadiens this week. Are you looking forward to the Tampa Bay-San Jose Stanley Cup final as the NHL's last hurrah?
If there's never an NHL again, its last Stanley Cup playoffs could be contested between San Jose and Tampa Bay. It's the first time Montreal's been swept in a series since 1998. Of course, the demographics of this series were just wonderful. Les habitants were depending on Alexei Kovalev, who is not an habitant, and yet the Tampa Bay Lightning were depending on Vincent Lecavalier and Martin Saint-Louis.
I did do that thing.
They should just wear the rouge, bleu et blanc and go as the Canadiens.
This week, the National Hockey League Players Association and the owners failed to make progress on a new collective bargaining agreement. They say they'll meet again in late May, but they did discuss shortening the regular season by 10 games. I guess that's better than agreeing to shorten it by 82 games.
At this point, the fact that they're talking and planning to talk again is something to look forward to. It is too long. So is the basketball season. Mm-hmm. So for that matter, you can argue is the baseball season.
I would agree.
In a negotiation where there was no sign of optimism for the better part of 3 years, this is a sign of optimism.
Charlie, it is, of course, Derby Day. Nicely done. This year's Derby
has been
called...
Don't you think?
Yeah, it's perfect. And this year's Derby has been called the most wide open in years. I'm sure that will not deter you from picking the winner as usual.
Well, I'm picking two winners this year, actually. There's a 50% chance of rain, apparently. If the track is dry, I'm picking Tappet, who's going off at 8-1, for those of you who wish to put a few milkshakes or soda straws on this thing. But
amusement
if it rains, I'm picking Kent DeSormo aboard Imperialism, mm-hmm, with Katie Mulhall, a rookie trainer.
21-year-old.
Who claims she's going to celebrate with bottled water if she wins the race. But anyway, Imperialism is terrific on an off track, and let's face facts, Bill, shall I say it, but it's been a great year for Imperialism.
Turkmenistan is now the home of a leisure center for horses. It's equipped with not only X-ray facilities and an operating theater, but air-conditioned stables and a swimming pool for the horses. Pretty much what Turkmenistan has needed all along, don't you think?
What do they call the big horse race in Turkmenistan? The run for the boulders?
NCAA President Miles Brand has confidently announced that there will soon be, quote, a sea change in college sports, which will,
Miles is going to his yacht
things,
on the Adriatic, is he?
These reforms would penalize schools if athletes perform poorly in the classroom. So this changes everything, right?
It does open up an entirely new field of chicanery. Schools are going to have to stay above what is being called a cut line that includes graduation rates as a factor of academic progress. Nobody knows what the cut line is going to be. I suspect the cut line is going to be anything that drops the television value of the NCAA men's basketball tournament down 50 cents.
We have a story about the brand of pro football played at the Division I colleges this week. It has to do with the always fascinating bowl championship series and the part that computers will continue to play in the jiggering of the hoo-ha as it regards the doodah or something like that. Have I got it right?
Yeah, pretty much. They're going to be less of a part of the formula. There's no details being revealed by my friend Mike Trangisi, of course. But he does point out that in all four of the new models they're going to use, Oregon would have played for the national title instead of Nebraska and Southern Cal rather than Oklahoma last year. So basically what he's saying is the computer got it wrong.
Finally, in Great Britain, fitness seekers who want to slim down while shopping can use grocery carts with adjustable resistance wheels and gauges for measuring calories burned, heart rate, things of that nature. In stores where these carts are in use, how many times do you suppose pyramids of fruit will get knocked over by people looking at the gauges instead of where they're going?
Well, first of all, this thing will never be practical until it can be provided with a voice function that says, "Put back the ringdings, you cow!" Second of all, this is awfully counterproductive because the most exercise you can get would be pushing around a heavier trolley, which means you've bought more food!
More food, of course. It's brilliant. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and offers shopping carts full of knowledge each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. Please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. There is a nascent fitness trend designed to attract those who've always wished they could crunch to the Clash, do sit-ups to the Sex Pistols, and exercise to X-ray specs. Only a Game's Gary Wallach recently attended punk rock aerobics, and he has this report.
You can find Hilken Mancini and Maura Jasper most Saturdays in the basement of the Middle East Rock Club in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Today, amid the mingled aromas of bleach and rancid beer, they prepare for their 2 o'clock aerobics class as club employees mop the sticky wooden floor. Mancini sets a boombox and stuffed animals on the dormant bar. Jasper hangs day-glow cheat sheets listing today's songs and their corresponding moves, which inspires a game of word association.
Ramones.
Great for jumping up and down.
Jogging in place.
Yeah, everybody knows who they are. Head everybody banging. Loves them. They're great for the person who's new to punk rock.
Mission of Burma.
We love Mission of Burma.
We love Clint Conway.
Hard to choreograph. On the downside, they can be too arty to get the class jacked up.
Yeah.
Buzzcocks.
We love them. Jump up and down. Great.
Pogo.
Pogo, too.
Pogo.
It's evident that these women are credible music historians, but one part of their punk rock aerobics equation was missing 3 years ago, namely their qualification to lead a class.
We had nothing.
We had nothing.
We had nothing and we weren't in shape.
So Mancini, best known for her guitar and vocal work with the indie rock band Fuzzy, and Jasper, a visual artist, went for their certification with the Aerobics and Fitness Association of America, the practical exam for which Maura and Hilken found, well, interesting.
And they show you how to correctly do these exercises and your gluteus maximus and your biceps and your triceps and whatever in front of everybody who's a total aerobicizer wannabe.
It is like your worst nightmare. It is everything that you ever hated about fitness,
and
exercise,
so Maura's,
gyms.
I'm going to go. I'm going to leave. I can't do it. I can't take it. I've got to go.
I was so scared and so freaked out that we were actually in that situation. And somebody's going to call you on it and say, hey, you two in the back, didn't I see that you were teaching this punk rock aerobics? You're out of here.
Mancini and Jasper persisted, earned their certification, and perhaps most importantly, experienced the humiliation many fitness seekers face when subjected to spandex and disco. Coldwell Banker marketing coordinator Dana Sibley is attending her third PRA class.
When I took classes before, I'd be 5 minutes into it and want it to be over. There's mirrors everywhere so you can watch yourself screw everything up. And, you know, and then the instructor comes over and she's like 98 pounds and just, you just feel like a complete jackass.
And you don't feel that way here?
Not at all, not at all. They're extremely supportive. They go around, like, during the class and tell you you're doing a good job. And even if you're not really, you know what I mean, or you don't feel like you are. So, no, I love it.
Sibley's classmate, freelance editor Amy Monahan, says punk rock aerobics is more than just an antidote to all those hours spent in front of a computer.
We come here, jump around, we look like an idiot. Nobody cares because they all look like idiots, too. And, you know, there's nothing more abject on a Saturday afternoon than laying on a club floor that still smells like stale beer and doing crunches to Iggy Pop. It's not quite rolling around in broken glass, but it feels like it.
We're going to start with stretching and a warm-up. It gets kind of dancey. There's three moves to each song. We're going to show you the three moves, put them to music, and hopefully it won't be too hard, but don't worry.
The class begins a half hour late, but no one complains. 38-year-old Maura Jasper, resplendent in her PRA t-shirt, black culottes, and argyle knee socks, leads the class of 12 women and 2 men in a warm-up. After a few minutes of stretching to the strains of Dinosaur Jr., the more aggressive exercise begins with an inverted jumping jack called the whack jack, followed by the skank and the teenage kick, with accompaniment courtesy of Eddie and the Hot Rods. Hilken Mancini, clad in sheer red shorts and Kermit the Frog tube socks, is a whirlwind of wavy blonde tresses as she kicks to the beat. The 34-year-old says the aerobic moves she and Jasper have developed are, like punk rock itself, meant to be simple and fun.
The moves are just things that maybe a 12-year-old girl would come up with in her bedroom.
Yeah.
And because we want to make it easy for people, what we came up with was the concept of, like, a punk rock song with 3 chords. We have 3 moves for each song.
We try to keep them really, really funny and easy to do. We want to be able to show you something and have you laugh and feel like if you try it a couple of times, you'll be able to get it.
I mean, obviously some of them are going to make people laugh more, like You Be the Star Air Guitar. It's like Dee Dee's Lunge. the legs, McNeil, just stretch. We screw up all the time. We laugh all the time. Like, it's not, you know, any sort of, there's no right way, which is why it's punk rock. You know?
The countercultural theme is in evidence today. One student sports camouflage shorts and fishnet stockings. Indie rock notable Mary Timoney exercises in a dark corner next to the club's elevated stage, the same one on which she's often been in the spotlight. But the class is less visually punky than one might assume. Hilken Mancini says there's a good reason for that.
Punk is a term that we've used about just doing something your own way. It's not about having green hair or mohawk or, you know.
Punk is a way of thinking. It's an attitude. It's an approach you take to your life and coming up with your own ways, your own rules.
Mancini and Jasper put that ethic to the test last summer as they wrote their book, Punk Rock Aerobics, 75 Killer Moves, 50 Punk Classics, and 25 Reasons to Get Off Your Ass and Exercise.
It killed us writing it.
Yeah, the book was written in about 3 weeks. But you know what? The book really does give people an overall idea of what punk rock aerobics is about in a much fuller way, and that it's not just about jumping up and down for an hour.
That we're also not poser hose bags. We know what we're doing as far as when it comes to punk rock and to the exercise. We're not just trying to cash in on a trendy name.
Hilken and Morris say they're aware of the conundrum they may face if punk rock aerobics becomes more popular. Though they're currently planning a workout DVD and a CD, and even considering franchising to other cities, they insist they'll fight the temptation to go mainstream. But during the cool-down, after Maura has left a Hershey's Kiss on the mat of each winded punker, she announces that tuition will increase from $7 to $8 per session. Could it be that our heroes are selling out even as they deny they ever will? Again, Amy Monahan.
We look at the economy is getting to be almost the same as the economy that punk came out of originally in terms of being really, really bad. And, you know, Hilken and Maura have to eat as much as the next person. So, yeah, you know, I'm all for it. I'm happy to give them the extra buck because that means that they can keep doing this and I can keep coming.
For Only a Game, I'm Gary Wallach in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our senior producer is Gary Waller. To order a tape of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15 postpaid. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to hear any part of this program again, sign up for our newsletter or exercise with the cyberpunks. Please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from punk rock aerobics instructors Hilken Mancini and Maura Jasper, who say they would welcome to their class anyone wearing a matching workout ensemble.
We'd be psyched. We like people that look like freaks.
So, you hear that? Former aerobicizers of the 80s? Now you're on the fringe. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Major support for Only a Game comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering discerning patients a same-day tooth replacement solution for failed root canal treated or missing teeth. Information is available online at Bicon.com or at 800-88-BICON.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.